Would you eat your dressy veggies?
A new risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
What happens if women take lithium during pregnancy?
And is there any benefit to an ultra-long-acting insulin?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on June 16, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I framed this one up, my favorite one, okay, I'm going to even promo that right off the bat for this week. That's the dressy veggies. A study in JAMA Internal Medicine taking a look at, hey, how we describe vegetable dishes and whether that renders them more likely to be chosen by people when they're at a cafeteria.
Vegetables are clearly a healthier food choice than many of the foods that we eat, especially fast foods. People rate foods that they perceive to be healthier as less tasty. As a result, oftentimes we don't choose them. Well, the question is, can we make healthy foods more appealing by just calling them something different or how we describe them? So this was an interesting study. It was done in a large university cafeteria where each weekday they counted the number of vegetables that people chose, and all they did was alter each week how they describe the vegetables. So for example, let's pick a vegetable like zucchini. So they could describe it just basically zucchini, or they could describe it as what's called a healthy restrictive choice. They called it lighter choice zucchini, or maybe a healthy positive way like nutritious green zucchini, or ultimately the dressy description as slow roasted caramelized zucchini bites. Compared to all the other descriptions, when each of the vegetables, and they looked at beets and corn and green beans, sweet potatoes, butternut squash, zucchini, carrots, and even bok choy and mushrooms, when they used the indulgent description, there was a substantial increase in not only people choosing that vegetable, a 25 to 40% increase, but also an increase in the amount as well.
I find this just really very curious, although I will say, and I know you've probably had this experience too, that some of these descriptors for food are truly examples of creative writing, and they do sound more palatable to me.
I mean, who could refuse the dynamite chili and tangy lime seasoned beets or the rich buttery roasted sweet corn? Kind of jumps out from the cafeteria line onto your plate. The next podcast, I want you to come up with an indulgent podcast name that will attract more listeners.
I'll do my best, but I think you might be better at that. Let's turn from here then to something else that's in JAMA Internal Medicine. A look at, just a little bit sobering, education and cardiovascular disease.
I mentioned this as a new risk factor for cardiovascular disease because we oftentimes talk about more commonly recognized ones like high blood pressure or diabetes. Educational attainment may also be a cardiovascular risk factor. So what these authors did was they estimated the lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease according to categories of different educational attainment. In almost 14,000 whites and African Americans who were middle-aged in four different areas of the U.S. These were all individuals who were middle-aged and free of cardiovascular disease. And what they discovered was that there was a significant inverse relationship between education and risk of cardiovascular disease. The higher your educational attainment, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. The lifetime risk for middle-aged people ranged from 59% to those that only went to grade school to 42% for those that had a graduate or professional school education. This was unrelated to the income that was attained.
I'm just wondering about the other things like cigarette smoking and alcohol use or dependency.
They did, in fact, correct for those things. Not only was this independent of income, it was also independent of occupation and parental education as well. If we intervene to create a higher educational attainment, could that be an effective way of lowering cardiovascular risk?
I guess for right now, the utility of this for me is that physicians need to be aware of the educational level of their patients with regard to potential screening. I think the other thing it calls out to is our need to develop targeted messages for people who are of certain populations that will resonate for them.
I think those are both good points. You know, my decision of how to treat someone with cardiovascular disease, how aggressive to be, depends upon what their risk is. And if we don't recognize that low educational attainment is a risk factor, we'll oftentimes won't treat people as aggressively as they need to be. So I think that point's well taken.
Okay, now let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, the other end of life. What if you're pregnant and you're taking lithium? What can the outcome be on the baby?
And this is important because a substantial number of women are taking antipsychotic medications, and lithium happens to be one of the more effective agents. In the 1970s, there was concern, based upon some observational studies, that women that took lithium during the first trimester of pregnancy had a 400-fold increased risk of heart defects that affected the right side of the heart, and a 5-fold increased risk of cardiovascular defects overall. What these authors attempted to do was to do a much larger study to nail down what is the actual risk. And they looked at over 1.3 million pregnancies. And these are women who were enrolled in Medicaid, and they delivered a newborn infant between 2000 and 2010. And they examined the risk of cardiac defects among those infants exposed to lithium during the first trimester of pregnancy, and also to women that were taking a different mood stabilizer, lamotrigine. And what they discovered is that for women who were exposed to lithium in the first trimester, cardiac malformations were present in about 2.4% of the babies. This is about twice the risk of women that weren't exposed or that were taking lamotrigine. And the cardiovascular effects seem to be dose related. So take the lowest dose possible.
Right, but probably not take it at all. I mean, I guess that's one of the things that's really challenging here, because people who have these kinds of disorders, when they are on something that works for them, that they're successful in taking, we know it's very, very problematic to have people either switch or to cease entirely.
But knowing that it is dose-related, if women have to take lithium to control their mood disorder, you want to be on the lowest dose possible.
Finally then, also in NEJM, ultra-long-acting insulin, is there a role?
There are many different forms of insulin. One we've used for the longest period of time is a short-acting insulin that lasts for several hours. We've been getting progressively longer-acting insulin that helps compliance. That's been shown to be more helpful to controlling sugar because we don't have these swings in taking shorter-acting insulin. We now have an ultra-long-acting insulin whose half-life is over 24 hours. There is concern among adults that have type 2 diabetes that those that use insulin have higher cardiovascular events than those that are not taking insulin. So the issue is, with this ultra long acting insulin, is there a higher risk of cardiovascular events? So they compared this ultra long acting once daily insulin to the long acting insulin called glargine in over 7,600 patients randomized to one of those two insulins. And they looked at cardiovascular events and then also hypoglycemia, because that's pretty serious as well. And what they discovered in following these individuals for over 2 years, most of them had established cardiovascular disease or chronic kidney disease. They were at high risk for having events. Over that 2-year period, the risk of cardiovascular events was similar for both types of medications. It ranged from about 8 to 9%. But those that took the ultra long acting had a lower risk of having severe hypoglycemia. At the end of 24 months, the hemoglobin A1C was the same, so it may be a good choice for many individuals.
In people who don't have diabetes, we do have really pretty dramatic insulin spikes. That's after we eat. Postprandially, we'll have this big spike. So I'm wondering about the physiology of a continuous level of insulin.
Well, what it does is it kind of smooths the spikes down a bit. Oftentimes, these people are taking not only insulin, but other medications as well. It lowers what I'm going to call the basal sugar or the basal glucose. That seems to be tied to some extent with the cardiovascular event rate. That is, the higher that is over a certain point, the more likely someone is to have cardiovascular events. So if we can lower that throughout the day, it's hopeful that we can lower the cardiovascular risk events. Now, by the way, some but not all studies suggest that insulin has a higher risk of cardiovascular events than the oral medications. The glargine in a large study appears to be similar to the oral medications. Because this ultra-long-acting insulin is similar to glargine, the assumption is it would also be similar to oral medications as well.
Well, I guess it's one of those things that we're just going to have to wait and see as there's more data that emerges when people take it over the longer haul. How expensive is this in comparison to the long-acting insulin?
Elizabeth, that information wasn't given, so I'm sorry I can't answer that, and I did not look that up before the podcast.
I guess I'm just looking askance at a lot of this because, as again, we're both aware, we know that there are all kinds of insulin preparations out there and things that are being put forward as the latest and greatest, and gosh, a lot of times they turn out to be pretty expensive.
They do. One of the reasons why I picked this particular study is because we use glucose as kind of a surrogate endpoint, and really what I'm concerned with is, well, So what if it lowers the glucose, but it increases the risk of cardiovascular events like death from heart disease or stroke or myocardial infarction, heart attacks? The nice thing is this particular study looked at those hard endpoints in almost 8,000 patients. So kudos to the investigators for doing that.
On that note then, of course, I'm going to talk about the dressy veggies on the blog, as I already said. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.